We're reading through Luke's Gospel. We're in chapter 6, and we're looking at the section which begins in verse 17. Jesus has been up in the hills. He comes down to a level place. A huge crowd of his disciples and other people are there. These people have come because they want to hear him, and they're hoping that he'll cure them from all sorts of diseases. And he does. And there's tremendous excitement. Everyone's trying to get close to him, to touch him. But eventually, he calms them all down, and he looks at his disciples, and he starts to talk to them. And what does he say? Well, he talks to them as if they were two groups. All these people call themselves his disciples, but they're not all the same. Among his disciples, there are some who are poor. They feel destitute, and they're hungry, and they cry often, and they're persecuted. And he says to those people, "Blessed are you who are poor, hungry, who are weeping now. Blessed are you when men hate you." And then he turns to the other group. And they're very different. They're rich. They feel they've got everything they need. They're well fed. They're laughing. All men speak well of them. And Jesus says to those people, "Woe to you who are rich, well fed, who laugh. Woe to you when all men speak well of you." All these people say they're Jesus' disciples. But there's one group who are his real disciples, and there's one group who aren't. And the mark of his real disciples, the people who are really blessed, is that here in this world they struggle. They feel poor and destitute and vulnerable. They find themselves aching, longing for things that aren't to be had here in this world. They're often weeping, and they're persecuted. Men hate them and exclude them and insult them and reject their name as evil because they belong to Jesus, the Son of Man. That's a very important phrase there at the end of verse 22. "Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man." All these things come on them because they belong to Jesus Christ, the Son of Man. Jesus isn't saying God's on the side of anyone who's poor, anyone who's hungry, anyone who's miserable, and God's on the side of anyone who's unpopular. There are preachers who have put that idea about, that by definition God is for poor people and he's against rich people. No, the point here is that Christ's true disciples experience poverty and hunger and weeping and persecution for the sake of Jesus, the Son of Man. All these unhappy things come to them because they follow him, because they're faithful to him, because they're determined to obey him. Now, last week we began to think especially about the way that Jesus' true followers are persecuted and the way they react to that. That's what Jesus talks about in verses 27 to 36. "But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." Jesus begins there by giving four great commands, telling us how we should respond in any situation where people persecute us for his sake. Command 1, love your enemies. When people act as our enemies, we must love them in return. We must carry on caring about them and caring for them. Command 2, do good to those who hate you. When people show that they hate us and when they try to harm us, we must react by doing good to them in every way we can, which includes telling them the gospel, but it also means doing our best to make their lives as happy and rich as we can. Command 3, bless those who curse you. When people pour down curses on us, when they shout that they want us to suffer, we must reply by blessing them, calling down God's blessings upon them, telling them that what we want is for God to be kind to them and to enrich them. And then command 4, pray for those who ill-treat you. When people harm us, if there's nothing else we can do for their good, we can pray for them. Pray that God will forgive them. Pray that God will save them. Pray that God will pour his kindnesses into their lives. So there you have 4 great general commands to deal with every situation in which people may have it in for us because we belong to Jesus Christ. But we need more than just these 4 great general principles, which is why Jesus then goes on in verses 29 to 31 to give us 4 particular examples of ways that people might treat us badly and the way we respond. Let's look at them one by one. Firstly, there's insult. Verse 29. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. To slap someone in the face, it was about the nastiest insult you could give to someone in Jesus' time. I suppose spitting in his face would be even worse, but slapping someone in the face was quite bad enough. It was a deliberate insult, a gesture of contempt. It was a sign that someone despised you completely and rejected you totally. Jesus says, if someone does that to you because you're a Christian, then turn the other cheek towards them. What does he mean? Does he mean that you deliberately provoke them to hit you again? I don't think so. That isn't going to do them any good, is it? You know, go on, hit me, hit me. I dare you, hit me again. I don't care. No, I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. What I think he's saying is this. You've approached someone, a neighbour maybe, someone at work, someone with a problem, and you've come offering them your friendship. You've come offering them your help. And they react with contempt. They sneer at you. Maybe they do physically slap you in the face. But one way or another, they signal the fact that they despise you and that they reject your offers of friendship. So what do you do? Do you say, okay, I tried, that's it. And you walk away determined never to go near that person again if you can avoid it. Jesus says no. You don't give up. The next time the opportunity comes, you go back to that person again. And yes, you know the same thing could happen again. They could smack you on the other cheek this time. But that doesn't stop you. You're exposing the other cheek to be smacked. You're making yourself vulnerable. You're exposing yourself to a repeated insult. Do you see? That girl at work, you found her crying in the toilets at break time. And so after work, you gave her a lift back home. And you took her in. And you listened as she poured out her problems. And you sympathized. And you tried to say helpful things. And without being pushy, you told her that you'd be praying for her. And you were so thrilled that God had given you the opportunity to befriend her. And the next day you walk into the office, and she's standing there with a gang of people around her, and she's telling them all about you, and she's mocking you, and the way that you offered to pray for her. And she's twisting the whole thing, and she's making it sound as if you had just dragged her into your home and then harangued her for hours. She mimics you in the cruelest way, and she makes disparaging comments about your home and the Bible text you've got hanging on your wall. And everybody's laughing with her, and you feel so humiliated. She's just slapped you in the face. So what are you going to do? Well, you're going to keep the four big commandments we've already talked about. You're going to carry on loving her. And you're going to look for ways to do good to her. And you're going to bless her and pray for her. But more than that, you're going to turn the other cheek. You're going to carry on trying to befriend her. Next time she's in trouble, you're going to offer your help just as you did the first time. Yes, you know now that she's a malicious person. You know that she's the sort of person who could use all your offers of friendship to humiliate you. But you make yourself vulnerable. You put yourself in the position where you get your face slapped again. You're willing to accept insult for the sake of Jesus Christ, who was insulted for you. Second example Jesus gives, harm, loss. If someone takes your cloak, don't stop him from taking your tunic. Now this goes beyond insult, doesn't it? If you're slapped in the face, it's humiliating. But that's all it is. That's where it stops. Jesus is talking now about the situation where people really harm you, where they inflict loss upon you. Specifically, the situation where people rob you. Imagine you're spending time now with a group of people. Again, you're trying to befriend them. You want to show love towards them. You want to help them if you can. And one morning you find that during the night, one of them has stolen your cloak. What do you do? Do you turn your back on them? Do you say, well, right, if I can't trust them, I'm leaving now and I'm not coming back. I mean, if I stay here, whoever stole my cloak is going to come back and steal my tunic next time. So I'm off. Jesus says, no. If someone's stolen your cloak, you must be prepared to put yourself in the situation where he could take your tunic as well. You stay. That's the price of loving your enemies. That's the price of doing good to those who hate you. Yes, you could finish up being stripped of everything in that situation. A man's tunic was his underwear. You could lose everything if you carry on. You could be left stripped naked. If you carry on trying to show love to wicked people, they may take advantage of it and leave you with nothing. But Jesus says that's what you do. It's been the experience of countless pioneer missionaries, hasn't it? They've gone to the most needy people in the world, and they've been willing to offer them medical help and practical help. They've been willing to dig wells for them and to teach their children to read and write. And above all, they've gone to tell them the good news of salvation. And every time they turned their back, they found that their possessions have been stolen. Read the story of John Peyton in the South Sea Islands, if you want an illustration of what we're saying. And then the question is, do they walk away? The missionary has to ask himself, if I stay here, what will the cost be? I could finish up with nothing. These people will rob me blind. Jesus says, you stay. If they finish up taking your tunic, that's the price you pay for trying to show his care to wicked people. Of course, the principle doesn't just extend to people who harm us by stealing from us. Jesus is simply saying, when people harm you in any way for my sake, then you accept it and you don't walk away from them. You put yourself in the position where they could harm you further. You make yourself vulnerable. Tim Mills, after he was called to the pastorate in Bradford, moved into a street where there was only one white family. And that family moved out not long after he arrived. All Tim's neighbours were Asian Muslims. He went there because he wanted to befriend those people, to show that he cared for them. And as God opened opportunities, he wanted to share good news with them. And Tim got on well with his immediate neighbours. But as time went on, he began to get hints that there were people who were determined to drive him out of that neighbourhood because he was a Christian, invading a Muslim area. And strange things, worrying things began to happen. Veiled threats and not so veiled threats. One morning Tim woke up, got up as usual, went to get dressed. But his clothes weren't there where he had left them, at the foot of the bed. Couldn't believe it, you know, sort of surreal thing to happen. Goes downstairs and he finds the place has been ransacked. But nothing's been stolen. These weren't thieves who had broken into his house. They were people who wanted to send him a message. They turned the house over just to show him that they could do it. And they'd moved his clothes from the bedroom down to the living room just to let him know that they had stood there in the bedroom and watched him as he slept. And next time, what would you have done? Apart from getting stronger locks, I mean, would you have moved? Tim stayed. And he's still staying. Still there, living in that street, living in that house with his wife and children. He made himself vulnerable. He exposed himself to harm. Try to show love to people who hate Jesus Christ. And those people are liable to harm you. They may steal your cloak. And if you carry on trying to show love to them, they may steal your tunic too. They may spread lies about you. They may do you down when you apply for jobs. They may ring up the local authorities to try to get you into trouble because of the way you bring up your children. And Jesus says, you accept that that's the cost. You accept harm for his sake, because he was willing to be harmed for you. And then example three that Jesus gives, exploitation. He says, give to everyone who asks you. And the key word in that sentence is the word everyone. You've decided that when somebody comes to you saying, I need help, you're going to give it. And somebody does. And you do give it. And there's a warm glow. You feel good about it. That is the way you feel, isn't it, if you give somebody else help. And then somebody else comes asking for help. And you think, oh, okay, I can afford it. And then somebody else does. And you think, I'm going to have to be careful about this. But the stream of people continues. How many people are you supposed to give to when they come to you in their need asking for help? Jesus says, give to everyone who asks you. But I can't afford to do that. I mean, I could finish up with nothing myself. Yes, says Jesus, you could. And why should I be giving to all these people? I mean, some of these people I don't particularly like. In fact, some of these people are people who have been really nasty to me. Some of them are people who have treated me very badly. And Jesus says, what difference does that make? This is about loving your enemies, isn't it? And then you find that some of the people whom you've given to aren't grateful at all. Once they've got the help they've asked for, then they turn against you, and they don't want anything more to do with you. In fact, some of them seem to resent you all the more just because you've helped them. And now they take every opportunity to be nasty to you. And you become very disillusioned. You become cynical about people. But do you still carry on helping others? Yes, says Jesus. That's the point of the everyone. I think he's talking firstly about money. But it's not just money, is it? It's time, it's effort, it's your skills. You know, a neighbour knocks on your door. She knows you're a school. She knows you're a school teacher. And she tells you all about how her daughter is struggling in school and is falling behind, and she's got this exam coming up and it's so vital that she passes it. Can you help? And you say, all right, I'll give her an hour's tuition each week. And you do that for 3 months. And you get her through the exam. And you think, well, at least I've won the friendship of that family. And when I next invite them along to church, surely they'll come, if only out of gratitude. But it isn't like that. Once she's through her exam, they don't want to know you. And they'll walk by you in the street and not acknowledge you. And as far as coming along to church at your invitation. So what are you going to do next time someone asks you for the same sort of help? Jesus says, give to everyone who asks you. Do you think Jesus never felt exploited and used? How many people did Jesus heal? And out of all of those people, how many became his disciples and followed him? Do you remember how on one occasion he healed 10 lepers? And out of them all, how many came back even to say thank you? One. And that one was a foreigner. But did it stop Jesus from healing the sick from that day on? It would have been easy for him to become cynical, wouldn't it? For him to say, well, if that's the way people react to my kindness, they can do without it. But no, he continues giving himself, giving his energy, giving his time to the needy people who come to him. He knows that the vast majority of them are going to be ungrateful. But still he gives. Do you remember how he fed a crowd of 5,000 hungry people? And at first, yeah, they're all wildly enthusiastic at first. And they're all shouting that they want to crown him king. And then when he starts explaining to them what he's really come for, they all walk away from him. They don't want to know him any longer. Does it stop him feeding the hungry from that day on? You turn over the page in the Gospels and you find another crowd of 4,000 standing before him. And again, he's giving himself to those people. Jesus accepted the fact that people would exploit him. And we accept exploitation for his sake. And then the fourth example. Jesus says, if anyone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back. And I couldn't quite find the right word to sum up what we're facing here. But I've just written down the word impertinence. Someone's taken what belongs to you, and they've no intention of giving it back. As far as they're concerned, it's theirs to keep. I mean, that is just so cheeky. That is so impertinent, isn't it? And this is someone you want to befriend. Or someone whom you thought was a friend. Are you going to let them get away with it? Jesus says, yes, you are. If the alternative is treating them like an enemy. You could demand it back, whatever it is. You've already asked politely. Oh, that power saw you borrowed, or rather, which you took from my garden shed without asking me. I'm going to need it next week. Could you drop it in tomorrow? And it's not been returned. Well, you could finish up demanding it. Right, I'm going to the police. As far as I'm concerned, you are a thief. And I'm going to deal with you as a thief. Now, you're entitled to do that. Legally, you're entitled to do that. Morally, you're entitled to do that. But you lose the opportunity to win their friendship. Jesus says you would be better to lose the saw than to lose that opportunity. There are times when you've just got to be prepared to stand the loss. And again, it's not just in terms of property that the principle applies. Jesus is simply saying that there are times when you swallow injustice. People do you wrong in one way or another, and you don't demand compensation. You don't demand even restitution. You don't demand apologies. You just write off the wrong that's been done to you, and you carry on caring for the person as if they had never wronged you. We have to do this in our own families, don't we? Someone in our own family hurts us, treats us unfairly, and they can't see it, or they're not willing to see it. Well, then we've got two alternatives. We can stand by our rights. Well, I'm expecting an apology. And until I get an apology, that is it. The way that lad has treated me is abominable. And until he's apologized, I am having nothing to do with him. The way my sister's treated me is disgusting. And until she sees it, I'm not talking to her. And you can stick by that. And the family is divided. And the feud goes on for the next 30 years and becomes engraven in stone. That's alternative one. Or there's alternative two. You shrug your shoulders and you say, it's not worth it. After all, we're family. She's my sister, after all. Forget it. And you wipe it out of your memory. And you treat her just the same. Now, that's the way most of us handle those situations, isn't it, in the family? When it's our brother, when it's our sister. Some of you who are parents, you've had to do that with your children, haven't you? They've behaved outrageously as they were growing up through their teens. And they've broken your heart at times. But you've not said, well, until I get an apology, until they recognize that the way they treated me back then was abominable, they're not coming across my threshold again. That's not the way you've treated your children. That's not the way you've treated people within your own family. Well, Jesus is saying to us here, if you can do that for your brother, you can do that for your enemy. The person who hates you and wants to harm you, show just the same forbearance, the same willingness to swallow injustice. So Jesus has given us four commands, and now he's given us four examples. And then finally, he gives us one summary. Verse 31. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Do you get the point? How are we to treat the people who insult us? The people who harm us? The people who exploit us? The people who act towards us in the most unfair way? Do we do unto them what they've done unto us? Do we do unto them what they deserve to have done unto them? No, says Jesus. You do for them what you wish that they did to you. You wish, don't you, that instead of insulting you and exploiting you and harming you and cheeking you, you wish that they would be caring and kind and considerate and helpful. You wish they would treat you like that. Well, then that's the way you must treat them. Let me say two important things in the last few minutes. Firstly, we need to ask this. The principles that Jesus lays down here, do they mean that we should never stand up against wrongdoing? that we should never resist people who go around hitting others in the face, or stealing from other people, or exploiting other people, or taking what doesn't belong to them and hanging on to it. Should we just let wrong be done and never challenge it? The short answer, of course, is no. Of course not. For two reasons. A, because we have to protect other people. If, for example, there's a con man who comes to me and spins a lot of lies to get money out of me, and I give him the money, but then I find out that he is a con man, do I just say, oh, well, no problem? Do I just smile at him and buy him a box of chocolates for Christmas? No, I'm going to report him to the police. Why? Because if he's not nailed, he'll do the same to the old lady across the road. And it's my duty to protect her. I can't just stand by and let him rob her and anyone else who believes his lies. And reason B, I have to protect the wrongdoer himself. There will be times when a wrongdoer mustn't be allowed to get away with things, for his own sake. Because if he does, he'll spiral downwards into worse and worse behaviour and finish up with his life in a worse and worse mess. We know that with our children, don't we? If, I'm sure it will never happen, but if one of my children were to steal chocolate from the cupboard, I wouldn't just ignore it. He or she needs to learn not to do that. So we'd rebuke and we'd warn, and if necessary we would punish for his or her own sake. Not because we want vengeance, not because we're standing up for our rights, but in order to help the wrongdoer. Now that is the key thing. When I'm faced with the sort of situation that Jesus is talking about here, I'm not to do what I feel I want to do. I'm not to do what I feel I've got the right to do. I'm to do what is best for other people. For other people who may be affected, and for the person, whoever he or she is, who has hurt me or harmed me. Sometimes that may mean rebuking that person, warning them. Sometimes it may mean taking action, reporting them to the police. But if I'm going to do that, I have got to be 100% sure that I'm doing it out of love for them, not because I'm against them. In every situation, I've got to be for the person who slapped me in the face, or who's robbed me, or who's exploited me, or who's grabbed my things and won't give them back. I've got to be caring about them. I've got to be determined to do what's best for them, whatever the cost to myself. In those situations, I must never act for my own benefit or in order to make myself feel better. I've got to say, I care about this person, and whatever it costs, I'm going to do what's best for them. I'm going to be a true friend to them. And then the second question I wanted to ask is this: is it possible? Is it possible to care about people in the way Jesus commands us to? Is it possible to carry on caring about people who smack us in the face, and who rob us blind, and who exploit us, and who treat us unfairly and don't even seem to realize that it matters? Is it possible to keep caring for those people and working for their good? Is it possible to live by the standards that Jesus lays down here? Well, he did. People smacked him in the face. And people stripped off not just his cloak, but his tunic, and they left him naked. And people exploited him, and they took away all his rights. And when they had done all these things to them, to him, he prayed that God would forgive them. And he was willing to die for them. And when he had come back from the dead, He came to offer them forgiveness and peace and friendship. And he sent his messengers to persuade them to turn away from their enmity and to accept his love as a free gift. Jesus lived by what he said. That's the way Jesus treated us. If we're Christians today, we can bear testimony to the fact that Jesus lived this out. We were his enemies. We ignored him, and we treated him with contempt, and we robbed him of the honour that was his by right. Some of you did it quite consciously, quite deliberately. Some of you were brought up in a Christian home, and you knew all about the Lord Jesus and about his love and his willingness to be your friend, and you deliberately turned your back on him and you said, "I don't want this Jesus." And then you spent the years that followed just refusing to have anything to do with him. You refused to even to read the appeals that he sent you in the pages of the Bible. And you refused to talk to him in prayer. And you deliberately set yourself to do the things that you knew he would hate. And through it all, he carried on caring for you. He carried on being kind to you. When you were in trouble, he brought you through it. He allowed you to have many happy days. He gave you lots of good things to enjoy. When you were ill, he restored you from your illnesses. Carried on being good to you, though you were his enemy. He carried on sending people to tell you that he cared about you. Carried on giving you reminders that he wanted to be your friend and your saviour. He could have given up on you, but he didn't. And the day came when he forced you to take notice of him. May have done it in one of 100 different ways, but one way or another he forced you to see that you needed his loving friendship. And he won you. He drew you to trust him. And since then, hasn't he been kind to you? You look back and you can see that you've treated him badly a million times. You can see that there have been so many times when if he were doing what you deserved, he would have walked away from you and said, "I'm having no more to do with that wretched, ungrateful person." But he's never done it. He's shown such loving kindness to you. Every real Christian looks back and says, "Jesus has loved me though I was his enemy. Jesus has done good to me though I hated him. Jesus blessed me when I cursed him. Jesus prayed for me when I ill-treated him." So is it possible to live like this? Answer, Jesus did. Jesus does. And that means that for his sake, his real disciples are determined to do the same whether they feel they can or not. And the wonderful thing is this: because they're united to Jesus, because he lives in them, they find they can. As the days go by, they find the grace and the love of Jesus welling up inside them to love their enemies. They don't often know in advance that they're capable of doing it. It's only when they set themselves to do it, it's only when they go to that ungrateful, unpleasant person that they find they can. Because it's then that Jesus gives them grace to do it. Without him, it would be utterly impossible. But with him, with the help of his Spirit, all things are possible. Love your enemies. Impossible. Do good to those who hate you. Impossible. Bless those who are cursing you. It's impossible. Pray for those who mistreat you. Impossible to pray for them sincerely and earnestly. Impossible. Unless Jesus lives in your heart. But when Jesus lives in your heart, all things are possible.